Okay. Agenda paper 12 is about exposure draft, onerous contracts, cost of fulfilling a contract, which is an exposure draft the board published in December last year. The exposure draft proposed to amend IS 37 to specify that the cost of fulfilling a contract comprises the costs that relate directly to the contract. The exposure draft also proposed to provide examples of costs that do and do not relate directly to a contract to provide goods or services. The exposure draft asks stakeholders two questions. The first question is whether respondents agree that IS 37 should specify that the cost of fulfilling a contract comprise the costs that relate directly to that contract. And the second question is whether respondents have any comment on the proposed examples. Agenda Paper 12 provides the Board with a staff analysis of comments in relation to Question 1 in the Exposure Draft. Depending on the outcome of this meeting, we will present an analysis of responses to Question 2 at a future meeting. Moving on to Question 1, a significant majority of respondents agreed with the Board's proposals. However, some respondents did not agree. We have analysed the reasons for respondents' disagreement and we have responded to them in the paper. We have also set out arguments for finalising the amendments now rather than postponing them to be reconsidered as part of the possible future project to make wider scope amendments to IS 37. Accordingly, we recommend that the Board proceeds with its project to make narrow scope amendments to IS 37 to clarify which costs to include in determining the cost of fulfilling a contract for the purpose of assessing whether that contract is onerous, and to specify, as proposed in the exposure draft, that the costs comprise the costs that relate directly to that contract. And I ask whether you agree with our recommendation.
Sure. I'll answer your question, but then if I can, I'm going to make a few comments on the analysis as well, if that's allowed. So the thing you're interested in, your question on page 19, I agree with the staff recommendation to proceed with the narrow scope amendment, mainly probably for a reason that I don't think you explicitly wrote down here, which is that my recollection is that when this came to the Interpretations Committee, we were told that this was a pretty urgent issue because of 15 coming in. And so, therefore, it seems that we were asked for a timely response, and doing a narrow scope amendment is consistent with that request, and I'd do that. I really don't agree with the rationale that we had in paragraph 76 for why we may not need to proceed, because I think we've got plenty of exposure drafts out there which we might have thought were great ideas that we decided not to finalise, and we wouldn't want people going around saying, well, that shows what the board thought. So I think we need to be careful with that argument. But I would agree with proceeding. In terms of the analysis, just a couple of observations. I agree with where we'd landed and sort of proceeding on this basis, but I think that we need to be careful to be aware of and respond to this concern that a number of people, maybe only a few, but they seem to think about it quite strongly, about this point about if my price exceeds only my incremental costs but not all of the other costs, that it's not the appropriate answer and it doesn't reflect the economics. Yeah. I think we need to take the time to respond to that and explain why we don't agree with that. I think your analysis in here on that is actually excellent, but I think it's really important to capture it. That there's a difference in our mind between having spare capacity, which you could go and sell, versus having committed to using that capacity, which locks you into keeping that capacity and only being able to recover a portion of costs. And so I think we're thinking about it slightly differently to the way that they're thinking about it, which is I'm better off because I'm at least recovering something. And our analysis is slightly different to that, and I think it's important they understand that difference in view. I also think it's important that we do respect the fact that they may need to then go on and explain to people why it's not the worst situation in the world because they are recovering these incremental costs. So I think anything we can do to help on the sort of disclosure front that we touch on in paragraph 35 to agree that that might make sense or to do more, I think might be helpful because I can see why it does worry some people. The other thing I just wanted to comment on briefly was the point raised about the unit of account and the staff conclusion about the unit of account and this idea that we could make a statement on the basis that we didn't include any requirements that would change this. I don't necessarily disagree per se, but I think we always need to be careful to be too definitive. I think we didn't intend to change the requirements in a way that would affect the unit of account, but whether there's something nuanced there that's making people think about things differently, even if it was what 37 always said, I think we just have to be a little bit cautious. And also, we can't really just make people feel comfortable because we've said in the basis, don't worry, it's all okay. So I think we just have to be a little bit careful with how we word that. So maybe an observation that we didn't intend to make a change would provide some comfort, but I'm not sure we could say much more than that.
To Dale.
Well, thank you for preparing the paper. I think that you have a very hard work answering all the comments. And I support the staff paper on the assessment of the answer one of the ET. I just want to clarify on paragraph 41, when it says that the proposed amendments would not stop entities from measuring onerous contract provision on the basis of the intended method of settlement. I'm just wondering whether many users now still have the view that the provision for onerous contract is measured on the lower of requirement. And then I think that the one that sent the letter was thinking about it could be based on the penalty, not the not based on the fulfillment. I just think that because this is in the one conclusion paragraph, I would just think about that.
Okay. We might have overinterpreted the measurement requirements in that respect and maybe in a different way from the others. I guess we don't really need this argument because we're talking about identifying onerous contracts, not measuring them. And perhaps if there is uncertainty on the measurement, if we are carrying this notion into measurement as part of the provisions project, we could look at it there with a little, you know, consider it there and not use that argument as part of this project, which I think we probably don't need to anyway.
And I think, if I remember, we already explained in the basis to the exposure draft that this we weren't sort of developing requirements on measurement, and we maybe just need to sort of reiterate that rather than
and
be careful
and
not to say anything else.
And step back a bit from what...
Gary.
Thank you. Like some of the other comments, I really like this paper and support the staff's recommendations and said it before, but I'm really impatient to get this one done because I actually think it's a very common and often significant practice issue. Like in my career, and any preparer would tell you the same thing, is needs for provisioning and reserves come, and there's always debate, well, what costs the account, you know, and I think not much an argument about the incremental, identifiable incremental cost. The only question is what do you do about the fixed cost or the one with the semi-fixed cost, and I think this gives a practical or reasonable answer towards it. The sooner we finish this, I think, the better. So when you say you'll come back to another board meeting for the second question, I'm hoping it's next month.
No pressure then.
To me, I think
that's
the only,
Craig's plan.
To me, the only issue or thing that caused some pause on, it's dealing with when the contract revenues, you know, deal with the idle capacity. And I think we need to differentiate. There's multiple types of idle capacity in the world. There's sort of longer cycle ones that are tied to cyclical trends, and then there's seasonal businesses. And if you're a seasonal business, I mean, any cash off season is great to have. Now, maybe the seasonality just cancels itself out over the course of an annual reporting cycle. And actually it should. But I think we just need to differentiate. The answer is the same for both. And quite frankly, I think if you're just pricing to recover your costs in off season, and all of a sudden your costs have been a little bit more broadly defined as some subset of at least semi-fixed costs. Maybe you'll price it differently. Maybe you won't. But again, I think the argument would be even if you, quote, lose money off cycle, it will cancel itself out. You pay me now, pay me later. Actually, the in-the-money business will actually look slightly more profitable if you write off some of the stuff that in your management model you would have accrued later. So again, I just think we need to you know, make it different. I think long-term cyclicality, idle capacity is different than seasonal. I mean, your accounting answers get to the same answers. I just think in the basis we need to say we considered both different, you know, idle models, if you will.
Chang Wu.
Thank you. I agree with Dr. Orr's recommendation here, and analysis is good. But one comment is on paragraph 69. We are talking about the unit of account issue here. And if you see the last sentence of that paragraph, appropriate to apply the owner's country requirements IAS 37 to a portfolio of similar countries. So this kind of interpretation of IS 37, any portfolio of any contracts. I just wonder if this kind of interpretation applies to some similar construction contracts, for example, not just a telco small contracts. This is kind of a general interpretation that can be applied all liabilities in IAS 37. So this unit of account is the portfolio issue is so, you know, so famous, maybe on a notorious issue that was discussed in IFRS 17 insurance contracts. Insurance contracts are not a typical liability contract similar to the IAS 37. So this one should be taken very carefully. So we need some kind of maybe additional thing to whether this can be applied to anyone in the IS 37 or some specific contract, very similar telco or some standardized or some kind of a manufacturing product, that kind of thing. So just I'm wondering.
I think the problem with IAS 37 is that it is completely silent.
Yeah, you're right.
But in practice, it is necessary in some circumstances to at least consider unit of account and consider either dividing big contracts or combining very small contracts. And at the moment, there is absolutely nothing in IAS 37 to tell you what to do. But in some circumstances, companies have to do something. Mm-hmm. And all we're saying here is that we're not changing anything here. Mm-hmm. And recognizing that in the particular circumstances of this particular respondent, there could be a good case for combining contracts without saying anything more general about when you would or would not. And I don't think there is much more that we could say without doing a fairly significant amount of work. While we were doing the provisions research project, this suggestion did come up that the board did add more guidance on unit of account for onerous contracts. And we did discuss it with stakeholders. And the general view was that there are so many factors to consider that it's probably best just left to deal with on a case-by-case basis in practice. And so even the people who'd originally requested more guidance actually said, well, we're not actually sure you could give us guidance.
Rika.
Yeah. Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for great analysis in response to the commentators. That is really helpful. I just want to suggest the question kind of about maybe my question is relating to the Gary's insight about kind of the large production line producing multiple products in the one factory of the country. So I think, what I see here is maybe in connection with the construction contract, I don't think there should be any practical issue to apply these amendments, but I only see the difficulty in applying this amendment a little bit is the industry, manufacturing industry, which produce some kind of the specific product to specific client, and then now their revenue recognized over period rather than point of period. In that case, the revenue recognized over time as well as the cost recognized as incurred. So in that case, and also if the factory use two type of the capacity for producing this product, meaning they need a special machinery to be located at a specific location. So that is necessary to meet the specification of the customer. So that is a kind of the incremental cost in terms of the onerous contract. But at the same time, the remaining part of production will be just produced anywhere in that factory, so they can use available capacity. But at the same time, beside that, producing specific customers' production, that company also produce standardizing product for almost more broader customers. In that case, the management can determine how to use the whole capacity in the future based on the what type of contract they entered into in the future. So that is a kind of the management decision in the future. And if there is a cancellation policy within the contract with that specific customer, in that case, management can decide to cancel whole production of that specific product by paying the certain amount of penalty. In that case, I really find the difficulty how the entity can determine what is a real avoidable and unavoidable cost. And if the cancellation is a little bit lower than the full cost incurred in the future, in that case, maybe the amount of the cost beyond the cancellation cost, cancellation penalty will be avoidable if management determine to cancel that product. So I think it's really important to clarify what the line between avoidable and avoidable if something might be element can be changed based on the future management decision. I have a question about this because of the IS 37 doesn't allow the entity to recognize future operating loss. So I think we should avoid the confusion between what should be included in the onerous cost and then future operating loss.
Okay. So I think, are you talking, because obviously the onerous contract test only comes into play in the context of contracts, yeah. You know, signed contracts as opposed to contracts that are not yet signed or whatever. Are you thinking about situations where you've got a contract but there's clauses in the contract to say management can make different decisions, or is it just that there's a clause in the contract that says management can cancel and decide to pay a penalty?
I think, what I mentioned about a contract with a specific customer, That's a closed contract, but which also includes the cancellation terms and condition. So management can cancel that contract if they pay the certain amount of a penalty, but they don't use the full capacity of the factory to produce that product. So even if, in the case, if the management cancel that specific contract, in that case, the cost will be fully absorbed by producing the production in accordance with a separate, different contract with other customers. Mm-hmm. So that can be a kind of the management decision in the
future. I think all management can do is estimate what costs it will what resources it will use to fulfill the contract and allocate the costs accordingly. It can't and probably doesn't have to get into thinking about what it would alternatively do with the resources if it didn't have the contract, mm-hmm. because the point is that it does have the contract. And okay, so if it could cancel the contract for a penalty, that will be another factor to consider. But I think it is this way of looking at it, that what you're trying to estimate is the cost of fulfilling the contract, not the cost that you would save by not fulfilling the contract. And it does, I think, allow for a slightly simpler way of looking at it. If you
I have a question about this one, because in the past, in some industry, when they recognize onerous contract, in that case, they only focus on the incremental cost.
Yes.
So perhaps maybe it is a lower cost compared with the fulfillment cost of the production. In that case, they consider that cancellation amount is incremental. And then that means that amount is only included on the onerous contract. Mm. That is one of the practice we've seen in the past. So I think this change of the amendment can affect the measurement of the onerous contract, definitely. So I think it's really important to stakeholders to understand what cost should be included as part of the unavoidable cost in the case of to recognize onerous contract.
It's very specific, so maybe it's good for you guys to chat offline on whether there's something you can do with clarity.
Yeah.
It might be.
I think it gets at the heart of what is happening here, though, in terms of this project, because this is all about trying to clarify what is meant by unavoidable costs and stating clearly it's about because you have the contract. It's not assuming you don't have, because you have it, what do you think it's going to cost you to fulfill that contract? And hopefully it'll flow through just in both the articulation of the principle that we're talking about today, and if the board decides to go forward, in exactly how we sort of flesh out and respond to some of the comments we received about the examples as well, because I think there was quite a lot of feedback in that which will be helpful for us in thinking about how to make that clear.
Martin.
And then, I raised it already last time, because my example was when the kind of company has their own building, has 10 flats, and 9 are already rented out. And this rent income covers all the costs of this building, and then they have an additional, the 10th building is not rented out, is empty. And if a company then says, okay, it's difficult to rent out, but find somebody with a low price, which is not covering direct cost, but only maybe incremental cost, mm-hmm. I would not see this contract as an onerous contract. It is still my problem with that, because it was a good decision, and in relation to all other kind of these contracts in the same building, I think it was a good decision and not onerous. And I'm still struggling with this kind of then calling that an onerous contract and recognizing a loss for this kind of additional last rented out flat. And I said it already last time, that I'm struggling with that, and I think that is still my problem, where I find this solution not intuitive. And I'm always, I said it all the time, if I, my test is always if I have to go to my CEO or the CFO in my old world and explain it to him. And for that kind of thing, it would be difficult for me because he would say, okay, it is a good contract because we have additional cash, which we otherwise have not. All direct costs already covered by the existing contracts. Why are you telling me accounting is an onerous contract and you have to take the loss for that?
But that's why I think it's very important that we focus in on this analysis, because I think the response that I would give have to you in response to your comment that this is better than not renting at all, I think the perspective is, but you know, you could have bet you if you'd waited, you might have got a tenant who would pay more. And so there's sort of an opportunity cost aspect, or I could have sold that space. And so I've locked in a loss by doing this. And I think that's the logic that's behind it.
Yeah, man, that was in the paper, but as it, I'm still struggling with this kind of rationale. That is my point.
Yeah. Because I think if you agree, Martin, your example fits exactly into sort of with the comments that talked about the idle capacity piece. So.
Tom.
Yeah, I'll sort of pick up maybe a little bit on what Martin just said. And I understand where the staff's going, and I'm actually sympathetic. I'm not even sure which way I would go, but I found paragraph 33 to be a little bit dismissive of what these entities are doing. In that, if we assume that management is knowledgeable and rational and competent, so I'll do Gary's example, but I'm going to keep Martin's in mind as well. Suppose I have seasonal slack. And so I go out, and I know I've got seasonal slack, and I sign a contract for 3 years. Every summer, I'm going to have a product come in, and I'm going to shove it out the door, and it's going to make a lot of money on an incremental basis because the management is rational, and they understand their whole cost structure and all that. In this case, future cash flows are higher. The stock price will be higher, and we will recognize a loss at time zero under the onerous contract rule. And that's what Martin's going at is, in some sense, how conservative should we be with onerous contracts? You need to remember, onerous contracts are an application of conservatism. In some sense, we have a choice of just how conservative we want to be. Bringing in all the costs is more conservative. We bring more loss forward. Incremental costs, we bring less loss forward. So I think the staff might still go there, but I think it should be a little bit more sympathetic that the managers can be rational and these can be very good decisions. And I didn't, for example, I found the statement, in other words, if an entity were to price all its contracts in such a way it would not cover its costs in the long term. Well, I don't think they're a rational management. They're going to cover, to quote, all their costs this way. They're going to do it probably the way they said, and they'll probably still keep pricing the seasonality contracts until such time as the main product uses up all the capacity or whatever they're going to do. But I think they're going to be rational. And again, same thing on the opportunity cost. If the management is informed and rational when they make the choice to fill it with the seasonality, I'm assuming they're looking down the road and they know the probability that something better will come along versus this comes along. And if they're being rational and they choose this, I assume that the probability of something coming along is relatively low. So that said, I think it's probably good because, you know, if I go back to my management accounting, you know, there's a ton of stuff where a lot of entities kind of incremental cost to themselves to death because really you're right, in the long run you do have to cover all costs. And so it kind of goes to just how knowledgeable our management. Is there any opportunity perhaps actually to use incremental cost to be abusive of the spirit of onerous contracts? I worry about that a little bit. Another factor about whether you could even do it, I think the assumption Martin makes and I made with the other stuff is that the additional production, the price would be independent of the price of the current production. Because a lot of times if you rented that other apartment at a low price, I think your other people come back and say, You know, it's not sustainable because we want the price break. So it's just really complicated. And I think on balance, I'm still supportive, but I think I'd like it written up a little more with more recognition that there is a logical basis for the incremental cost case and that we shouldn't just be too dismissive of it.
I think that's a good point, because there is a logic to it, and we don't want to sound dismissive, and we don't want to imply that management would be behaving irrationally or in any way incompetently. But there are, if in your example, seasonality, if you have a seasonal business, there are times when you make losses. And all that this is doing is not is saying we are recognising that there are times that you make losses, and in the particular cases where you lock in on a particular point in time to these losses, you're going to be recognising them at that point in time rather than in the slack period over the course of the slack period. And so I can see we need to write it up correctly and not be too dismissive of the good arguments for incremental approach. But I do think that even in seasonal businesses, the fact that it means that you recognise losses is not misleading information, it's good information.
Okay, so we'll show more understanding, but it'll still be tough luck. Jen Chow?
Thank you. First of all, I agree with staff's recommendation. I think because it is an urgent issue arising from applying IFRS 15, so I agree we should make a narrow scope amendment to IS 37, not wait until our greater, larger project with regard to the provision. Secondly, what kind of costs should be included? I think we had a lot of discussions. I'm thinking about that. Actually, we're focusing on the cost of fulfilling a contract. That is the fulfill cost. So I'm thinking that if there is only one product, yeah, and I need to fulfill, you know, I need to deliver that product to the customer, what kind of cost I should consider and it should be included in the cost of fulfill my obligation. I think so-called incremental cost is not enough. I have to consider all the costs, not only incremental cost, but also other directly related costs. So with regard to other contracts, once we say I should fulfill a contract, I think without only considering incremental cost, is this one part cost, and cannot fulfill the obligation to deliver the service and the product. You have to consider other direct related costs, such as you have to utilize other resources, including fixed assets and human resources as well. So I think conceptually it's justified. I agree with the conclusion, and it is also consistent with the IS 2 and existing our IFRS 15, particularly IS 2. I think it's using the same concept as we developed. So I agree with staff's conclusion. With regard to the Chung's point mentioned about the units of account, I do think this is a very important issue. But I appreciate that based on the paragraph 70. We mentioned that although we will not make amendment to the standard, but we are going to address this issue in the basis of conclusion to provide some statement explanation. I think that will be very useful for the practice. Lastly, I have an observation with regard to the meaning of unavoidable costs. Because we mentioned the cost, what's the cost it is. And the standard said that cost should be so-called unavoidable cost. I think we can also mention a little bit about this. And we provide two interpretations with regard to the meaning of the unavoidable cost, and we adopted a second interpretation. I think second interpretation is consistent with the basic concept that I mentioned, that is the full cost. If you are going to fulfill that cost, that contract, because you have to fulfill that contract, what kind of cost should be included? So basically, I agree with that interpretation. But I have an issue come out, because whether this is consistent with other standards, if this is consistent with IS2, it's no problem. But when I look at the IS23, that is the borrowing cost standard, paragraph 10 actually using a similar wording, unavoidable cost, with regard to what kind of borrowing cost could be eligible for capitalization. And the paragraph 10 of IS23 mentioned that those borrowing costs that are eligible for capitalization are the borrowing costs that would have been avoided if the expenditures on the qualifying assets had not been made. So the wording exactly similar to the first interpretation, not the second interpretation. So I think if we are going to using this notion, we should clarify further that interpretation with regard to the unavoidable cost applied to this standard, mm-hmm. but not applied to other standards.
Okay.
Yeah, because other standards actually have different interpretation with regard to unavoidable costs, because this notion is really important, what costs should be included.
I'd never noticed that before, but yeah, it is different.
Okay, Mary?
In terms of the question, I agree with the staff recommendation, subject to identifying two things that I think could change my view in terms of finalizing. One is the timing. One is the interaction with the newly active narrow scope amendment project that we're due to talk about again in October. I'm looking at Joan because you're working on that, and I think I'd like to know before we do the final vote on this project whether in that narrow scope amendment project we're planning to address measurement, and if we are planning to address measurement, if we're planning to address it in a way that is different from the way we propose and tentatively deciding to confirm, which is direct rather than incremental. So I don't want to hold this for finalization of the narrow scope amendments or roll them all into one, but I think I want to know at least what we're planning to propose in that narrow scope, because I think I'd have a hard time going to Martin's bosses and saying, well, when it comes to identifying what is onerous, we're saying it's direct, but when we are when it comes to measuring how much, we're going to take an incremental approach. I want to know we're not going off in other directions.
Okay.
And the other project is at a much earlier stage, so we won't be talking about finalizing. We'll just be talking about what we're proposing. So that's one thing that could change my mind about support, Craig, for your proposal here. And the other thing is whether or not we can get any more information for the question of whether users find for this idle capacity issue, the direct approach producing useful information. It's very last minute. I don't know if there's any chance of using the upcoming CMEC meeting to maybe just check. I don't know. It may be too late in terms of planning the agenda for that. But it just, you don't seem to really have that much information in this paper. Sorry, let me direct myself to Craig again rather than Joan. Don't seem to have that much in this paper about the views of users on this point. I think you're mostly talking about the views of preparers. So those are two things. The third point is I just want to urge some caution about the paragraph 4041. I think you brought out, and several people touched on this earlier in our discussion, you brought out a very good point in paragraph 40 that we're only talking about the test to determine whether a contract is onerous. We're not talking about providing any guidance on measurement. And yet paragraph 41 seems to go kind of into guidance about measurement. So I think I would like to not make comments about how you measure, because the higher, you know, the lesser of penalty and unavoidable cost to fulfill is only in respect of identifying which contracts are owners. So I think we should be careful about that.
I think that's a similar point to the one you were making, Tadeo.
Yeah, Tadeo, and it may overlap a bit with what Rika was saying.
Fair call. Yeah. Yeah. I think we pushed a bit yeah. further in those paragraphs than we should. Yeah.
Gary.
You need to reflecting back a little bit more on idle capacity and so on, and several other people in front of me raised these issues, but a few other things came to mind that I don't think we're going to get out of the room unless we address them in some capacity. First, my own preference would be, if it's truly seasonal and cancels out for the year, I think we got to reflect that we write these standards for annual reporting. Is there a knock-on effect on interim reporting, or do you just you don't worry about it in reporting if you're reasonably certain it cancels itself out over the course of the year? I don't know the answer, but I think we have to address that situation. I think it's very common. A couple of people mentioned the word opportunity costs. I personally, we should avoid that phrase in the standard. I mean, that's going to scare the hell out of people. They're going to accrue for opportunity costs. We have to consider them. I mean, it might be a good business thing or managerial finance thing to do, but I think that we should avoid that in our standard here. Then in Craig, maybe you and I can take it offline. I don't know if it's for the next thing meeting where you want to talk about examples of what are or not costs that comply, but I think there's a difference between idle capacity and excess capacity. I think it's going to be a fine line. I think we got your examples here say idle. To me, idle means it's not used. And I'll give you a real life example. Let's say you build an office building for 1,000 employees, and you're at 800, you might just shrug, okay. Well, now I'm at 300. Well, you'd say, is that how much excess is in there? It's not idle. So everyone's got an office three times larger than planned, but doesn't mean the building's not used. Then you get down to you got three employees in it. It'd be stupid to keep the building open, but you'd say, well, they're doing something. It's not idle. So I think it's probably in substance idle, you know, or something like that. In contrast to excess, if you have a factory, you know, that could make 100,000 units of something and you're only working at 80,000, but you're profitable as a whole, and just deal with the fixed overhead and the overhead burden in your standard cost system. I would say that's excess, but it's not. But you don't have 20,000 idle capacity units in there. So I think this is all cost accounting, managerial accounting we used to work for. We should just take it offline. That's got to get articulated in here.
I agree with the staff recommendation. And in relation to this issue of how do I look at a contract that, in fact, with that contract I'm better off, and that would justify, in the view of some, going for incremental cost. I'm sympathetic, of course, if you look at it marginally. But I think we should look and agree very much with what Chan Chao's side, that what we are going to represent is the contribution of that contract to the profitability altogether. And if you really limit the assessment on incremental cost, then you have you're going to show ultimately in your income statement through your gross margin, in fact, a reduced margin because of the loss that you have not recognized to start with. So I think it has to be looked, and I think you started that in your analysis when you counterbalance with the loss that would not be computed for idle capacity. You have that idea there. But eventually, to capture it more in terms of contribution to the profit, mm-hmm. Would make things clearer.
Tadeo?
Just one point, what Francois just raised, and I saw in some of the comment letters that we received, that, again, I do support the conclusions of the staff. But one point that was raised was that just looking at the cost side, but what are the benefits of entering into a contract? I mean, that maybe the point is not in terms of the cost, but the benefits I'm getting from the contract. And I may end up just looking at a single number as my revenue, but I may think about the, all the benefits I can get from the contract. And then when I put this together with my costs, that even if it includes the direct related costs, I may still get a profitable contract because I'm getting other type of benefit, not just revenue. That's one of the points that was raised in some of the comment letters that I believe it's fair. I mean, the contract looks like, from the nominal amount only, the loss contract. But when I look at the benefits and it takes into consideration idle capacity, et cetera, you see that actually I'm getting some benefit from it. And how are we factoring this into the analysis whether this is an onerous contract or not? That's a fair point raised in some of the comment letters.
I think if I'm right, John, that's going outside. So obviously what we're doing here is very narrow, just looking at costs. We know from, I think, the research work, isn't that right, John, on IS37, some questions have come up in the past around the economic benefits leg of the test. But at least we wouldn't be touching that in this project. We'd only be focusing on costs.
Okay.
All right. Can we support staff's recommendation?
13.
Okay, very good.